are you guys talking about?
Okay, everybody, welcome to another episode of What Are You Guys Talking About? Today we are going to be talking about 2020's hosts. It's officially 2021. Yeah, it came out in Fright Fest, I believe in the October Fright Fest. It might have been the August one. I didn't watch it on either. But a Fright Fest favorite. It made number 3 or number 2 on the iTunes Horror. And at that point, I said, I'll give it a watch. And there's reasons for that, which we'll talk about, as to why it got a lot of attention all of a sudden. But it is a great film, which we're going to talk about. Very much indie, very much at the heart of what LVP Studios do, so we'd love to kind of discuss what we loved about the indie vibe on this film.
Absolutely. It was a good shout from you, I think. And it's funny because you primed me a little bit. You were like, listen, it's very like indie. And I don't know what I expected, but I was kind of blown away.
Cool. Well, we'll talk about that in first impressions in just a second. Before I move on to that, guys, I just have to get it out there. Really, I'd love for you guys to be checking out the website right now. It continues to grow and to have great things there, and I'm always surprised that people aren't regularly checking it for new content. So www.lavictoriaproductions.com, that really has everything. That has What Are You Guys Talking About, Dirty 20, which has, you know, now 63 episodes plus the Carnival Lore stuff, so those two great stories read by Ed. It has a sizzle reel, has all the projects that we're working on, some which we're not even working on anymore, but have sat there just in case anyone else is interested. It's really just a plethora of things. The only thing that hasn't been updated lately is the blog. I do that very sporadically, unfortunately, because we're always putting out content and other things. But please check out the website, watch the sizzle reel, let us know if you'd like to get involved in anything. We've had lots and lots of meetings in the last 2 to 3 weeks, kind of with everybody trying to get our projects finally put together, and generally just blushing. I mean, I don't know about you, Ed, but I blush at some of these calls because people are just so complimentary, you know what I mean? And it's one of those things.
It's pretty cool. You know, we got to talk with someone who's worked on like Rogue One, which is one of my all time favorite films and stuff. And
that's right.
And you know, it reminds you of why we do this when, you know, he turns around and says, you know, but like I want to do what you guys are doing and make my own stuff, and you know, yeah, so humbling is definitely a good word to describe it.
Yeah, I think the experience is always humbling like that. But, you know, top tip for the week coming from producer Jay, it's really helped to pick up our game around here. If you're not attending meetings via Zoom to keep up with people, and you are filmmaker, because a lot of people listen to this because you are filmmakers, do it. Set them up. It really helps. We were slumping, I would say, in December, partly because I was really busy with work, but also because it's December and it's winter and we're in COVID, and you know, it's still COVID, so no one can see each other. I went over to Eddie's today briefly for business related matters, and we saw each other for all of 10 seconds and wanted to cry because it's just horrible right now, and everybody's in the same boat is the only thing that's happened. And you know, I think the best example of that, Eddie, for posterity has been we've had all that snowfall, right, and the hill behind my house is like sled central, and you want to kind of yell at people because there are a ton of people on that hill,
right?
But in the same sense, like, everybody's just had such a long winter already. It's been so horrible. You know, it's great to see kids having fun, you know, and doing things that are cool.
Yeah,
so.
very true.
So, okay, so without ado, you know, check out the website, go check out social media. All the sites are listed. You know, Love Victoria Productions has a site on Facebook and LinkedIn. We have Instagram accounts, Jesse J. Shiro and Anno LVP, Twitter accounts, Mouth Love Victoria, and Anno Prod, and Anoski Prod, sorry, for Twitter. And then finally, you know, the easiest way if you want to get a hold of me is Facebook. Just find Jason Chirot, and that's usually what I check on a day-to-day basis. But at any rate, just keep the chatter alive, guys. This is one where there's lots to talk about, so if you guys want to talk about it, then please drop us some questions.
Man. Yeah,
we'll go search out the director.
It's been cool also, like, you know, people reaching out through the website and stuff, and you know, we get to talk to people. So, yeah, reach out. Let's talk. You know?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Like, we had two people contact. We had an actress contact us that way, and a couple other people. But there's a button on the front page of the website. Just click it, and it literally sends an email to me saying, "Hey, somebody wants to talk to you." And we set up Zoom meetings right on the back of that. So even if you don't want to have a Zoom meeting, you just want to say, "Hey, man, what's up?" Like, we love it. We read it all. So please, by all means, drop us a message.
Yeah.
So, without out of ado, let's do first impressions.
Yeah.
Talking about Host. So, Ed, why don't we start with you, because you already had some thoughts on this. What were your first impressions of Host? Who would you say this movie is geared toward?
Oh, that's tough, because I think that it's a well-crafted balance of a very sellable horror idea. Mm-hmm. And I think that it has a really interesting bit of writing to it, in that it takes the melodrama of the soap opera and mashes it with horror, right? Which I don't know if I'm not the horror head that you are. I'm sure you could name like a dozen films that have used that before, but I felt it was a very fresh idea. You know, in the same way that, you know, when I first watched Shaun of the Dead and I thought, what a great blend of the rom-com with, you know, horror and zombies and stuff like that. So, very smart, very, very well made, but clearly by people who had limited resources, right? Like, and I think that even though it does have mass appeal, I think that the people who would appreciate this the most are filmmakers who are like, oh, wow, this is, you know, great use of visual effects, you know, that are within the reach of most people, right? Incredible use of cinematography and lighting to really sell a mood. Camera movement that was on point throughout. Just all of these filmmaking elements that you're like, I can do that. That's within my grasp, right? Hmm. And so even though the finished product is not, you know, it's not one of these like Saw hits, right? Which was fairly low budget, but just made like a ton of money, right? Or Paranormal Activity or something like that, right? So it's not quite that. But I think it shows so much potential, and I think it's the kind of first film, you know, debut film, that I would love us to have. Like, this would be amazing. This is something to aspire to, definitely.
Sure. Yeah, I would largely agree with that. So I'm a bit more well-versed, because I'm regularly on kind of the Fright Fest and horror film circuit.
Right, right.
But Ed's pretty much hit the nail on the head with this. Listen, as far as a general film, so if you're sitting down on a Saturday night and wanting something to watch, does this film fit that bill? Yes, it does. And that's why it hit number 3 on iTunes. That's how I said how I got a hold of this, is because somebody on Facebook via the Fright Fest group, I think, just said, oh, by the way, this just hit number 3 on iTunes. You should watch it if you haven't seen it.
Uh-huh.
It also has one of the, you know, it received Death of the Year from Fright Fest. Well, well deserved. Like,
interesting.
That was part of, I didn't say the experience was ruined for me, but I was warned before I watched it, and really, you should never do this to people. Like, I did this, in my view, a better way to Ed when I said it's really gory. Instead, someone warned me that there was going to be a really horrible death scene. And so for me, because I watched so many horror movies, I saw it set up perfectly in this film. Now, that being said, again, if you are indie filmmakers, so as I said, we get tons of people in the States listening to this, and I'm pretty sure indie filmmakers, but lots of people on the show. If you are indie filmmaker listening to this for more advice on indie filmmaking, this is a movie to watch, because it is not, my original comment is, as a general movie, you could watch it once. You're not going to want to watch it 20 times. You're not going to want to watch it 100 times. I don't think it was ever sells itself. It's not a Hereditary. It's not a Midsommar. It's not a St. Maud. It is not a high concept film. It's right. Very simple. And a part of me was really happy about that, because there have been a lot of complaints about the return, kind of the high concept horror. And while I want to make a high concept horror, and I would love to do that, I completely agree that they're not always the best things for the box office, because, you know, Hereditary was one where half the audience walks out saying, this sucks. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right, right. It's divisive, isn't it?
Yeah, so I'm like, and you know, who knows how things are going to be once we all get back into the cinemas. So it's just one of those things where this is a film that you could easily sell. So from a production standpoint, a Hereditary is, you can sell when you've got an Ari Aster behind it kind of talking about how great it is and knows it now. This is a film that I would take even if I didn't know so much about the background, because it's commercial.
Because
it has the soap opera elements of it. Part of that comes from the fact that you know, as low budget artists, we usually need actors that are doing more of that kind of style of acting. And if you look at all the different actors in this one, they all have good histories. They've all acted before.
Yeah.
But obviously their mainstay is either, you know, horror movies or again, these more kind of soap opery type, you know, straight to DVD kind of things.
But fascinating because, you know, the soap opera is a, I mean, in the States as well as in the UK, right? But in the UK, EastEnders, Coronation Street, right? Like, these things have been going on for years and have, like...
That's right.
And, popularity for a reason, I think.
And so you said, like, you know, has this happened before? Yes. So first impressions would say this will be like the other ones you've seen at that level. So if you've gone to a Fright Fest and watched people's first films, this is going to be very much within your expectations. If you haven't watched a first director's films... All I would ask you to do is keep in mind what Ed has said. So I, you know, I would hate for you because Ed before the podcast was commenting. He's like, I did some research on IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes, and some of the reviews were horrible. And I think that's from people that don't understand where this film sits.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Exactly. Like, exactly.
This is, you know, your first feature film, at least for us in the horror genre, okay? Because I'm pretty sure our first feature is going to be a horror feature. There is a small chance it could be something else that Eddie is working on, but largely for promotion reasons alone, you know, because I just have a lot more context in that sector, you know, we're going to do a horror movie. And we've seen them done by most of our friends, and so, you know, these guys aren't our friends, but it follows the formula. The camera work is exquisite, and that's how you take low budget and take it just past that point so you can make it look like it's worth a lot more money than it actually is. That is why we keep saying this to you. But it's not us just saying it to you. This movie reaches epic proportions on iTunes because everybody's stuck home in January.
Right.
So that's why you do it.
The circumstances do kind of play in its favor.
When it looks good and it's released on iTunes, because what iTunes does is as simple as this, guys. There's no magic to it. iTunes Weekly comes out with like their specials and stuff like that, and they have their top recommendations. This is going to be recommended to you if you go into your horror genre category or if you go into a budget one where they were selling it for like $5. But the point is, either way, it's going to come across your radar, and I pick up a ton of films this way because they're cheap, easy, and, you know, simple to watch. So that's what I'm saying here. He's giving... You know, the two people that made this, which I believe are Richard Oakes and Adam... did you catch Adam's last name?
Preacher? No. Hold on.
Adam... Hold on. We're getting it up.
Leader.
Adam Leader. So that's kind of the brain children behind this. And I think they were very smart from a production standpoint to see and show, you know, that they could make a commercial film that other people would want to watch, but also keep it pure to horror. So... Only precursors, as I said, for first impressions, before we go into spoilers, again, is saying it is gory, okay? There are... This isn't one for, like, if you can't handle blood and guts, there are points where this is going to get blood and guts big time. So just please, like... And that's part of the reason it makes a good horror movie and a good one-off watch, because it'll give you a couple of jump scares in there that you'll really enjoy.
Definitely.
But it's just, if I'm giving first impressions before spoilers, that's my warning.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so that's first impressions, and we've done that bit now. We're going to get into spoilers, because I want Eddie to talk a little bit about, you know, what it was about the camera work that made this just so spectacular. So now you're coming on the show, you've watched the film, maybe you thought it was good like this, maybe you thought, why are these guys talking about this? I can go into a bit of depth about the story and why it works, but let's talk about, from your end, the camera work, and what you liked about the camera work that made it so professional to you.
Okay. I think that the opening shot is really fantastic. It's the opening credits, right? And it uses a, you know, moving camera up this seeming kind of hole in the ground. You see the sky, and the names are kind of floating by. And, you know, again, it wasn't anything spectacular, but it was just quality enough for an interesting opening shot that actually plays an important role throughout the film. You know, when we talked about Ari Aster and his, you know, Midsommar and that first shot that's so important, you know, it feels like a great staple of horror. But later on, the building of tension with camera angles, there's a moment when Jack... who we meet as the train driver, he goes outside into the garden to check, like, some lights that they've seen. And just from the very moment he steps outside, you get a crane shot moving down. You get these low angle shots, which are a little bit Dutched, like just a little bit off center. And this beautiful bit of kind of night lighting. And again, the camera keeps moving throughout this whole thing. And it's really great tension building. Really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, we were talking about this in, because we also want to do kind of an outdoor flashlights in a field bit. And this gave Ed, you know, for Noche de los Muertos, which is one of the short films we're working on at the moment. And there's a scene in this, one of the tension building scenes, which I'll bring up. So it's it's a scene, it's very early on. It's basically, because this I will say that the intro to this film did have almost a surreal kind of aspect to it. It's another thing I liked about it. When we talk about story later on, I'll get into that. But for the sake of the camera shot, like, what happens is he's home, you know, they're having this really kind of, again, it reminded me of Hollyoaks. I don't know why it reminded me of Hollyoaks more than any other soap opera, but this reminded me of Hollyoaks or Neighbors. Like, like the two soap operas I was going for on this one. And so you're having that soap opera moment, but then it switches to, like, a really good moment of fear, and they did it just by, it was, I think it was camera work and sound, Ed, but yes, it's like
the sound design,
just because it's the other thing in the background that's really subtle but good. The sound design is really good on this film.
Brilliant.
And I'll talk about that a little bit, because I watched it twice, and the second time is when I picked that up and said, that's the other reason he's done really well here. So the sound design comes in and starts letting you know, uh-oh, like, we've got a tense moment here. And then you get this look at the second of the, there's two characters that are going to play the villains. You know,
Lucy and Jack.
So Lucy sees something, but it's the way that she sees it. And it's that kind of really good, subtle acting, which, you know, the acting isn't amazing in this film, but this part, she did it really well, because all of a sudden you just see two, they're literally going to be like two guys with flashlights at the bottom of the screen running by a window. But it's the way she reacts to them that just sends chills to your spine, because she's not looking at them normally. You just saw them and were like, well, they didn't look too weird to me. And the best part he does is the other actor has that impression too. He doesn't see them, and so he's like, what's the big deal? But her face tells you, there's something weird. And then instead of showing you the lights again, which are low budget and what they could afford, she describes what they're doing. And I loved it, because it made it low budget indie, but it made it work. Because the other thing that's going on is, you can see brief, and this goes on throughout the film, another really good special effect that's probably dirt cheap. I don't know. But it looked, you know what I mean? It looked amazing. But then I was thinking in the back of my head, this must be dirt cheap, is the lights in the eyes.
Oh, so, yeah, that was really good. Really subtle. And again, yeah, within grasp of anyone who can use After Effects.
You know? No, that's what I mean. That's a horror trope, guys. I'm going to use it in my horror films. Change their effing eyes. Why? Because it, for some reason, as human beings, it makes us freak out when we see eyes done a different way. You know what I mean? As I said, all hail to, and I won't mention him on the podcast now because he's in a bit of trouble, but Marilyn Manson is probably the first person I ever remember doing that, right? And it used to freak the heck out of me with the stuff, you know, the two contacts that he had with that. So we won't mention him further on the podcast. He's in a bit of trouble in a big way right now.
But speaking of the acting, because I want to kind of get this out of the way, because, you know, at the beginning, and this is where, like, as the film went on, I got more comfortable with the concept of the soap opera. I think it's actually after we'd spoken and you kind of were like, yeah, I love this kind of, like, EastEnders vibe that it's kind of got. And the more I watched, I was like, okay, cool. But the kind of schmaltzy couple at the beginning just was like, it wasn't working for me. But honestly, they flip it on its head when they kind of become the possessed, you know, things. It was
incredible. I mean, that's not like I read that anywhere, Ed. That was just me kind of, that to me when I watched it, like the and we do have to get a bit into a story now. So there's this juxtaposition throughout in this thing between cutesy and chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that interplay, that push and pull throughout the story that makes it so watchable.
Hmm.
What do I mean? Well, when it starts out, it's almost surreally soap opera-like. So you have, you know, the intro credits, which don't make much sense, if I'm honest. I like how Ed has put them in, because they do look professional. But immediately after there, if I'm honest, Ed, I was like, not quite sure why we were coming out of the ground there, but okay.
Yeah.
And so,
I mean, it's a cool shot that I think maybe they were just like, oh, we can use this cool shot, which I understand from a filmmaking point of view. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like something they had and they were like, well, where should we put it? It's like, it would be great opening credits.
Mm.
But then you have that walk through the forest. You have the train scene where he's getting done with that. And then the walk through the forest. This is all in Oxfordshire, by the way. They filmed all of this in Oxford. They actually had use of a real train for that. They were given, because they were so good with Oxfordshire Council, the train was allowed to be used. But there's that scene where they're meeting, and that's the first like soap opera Hollyoaks moment for me, where he's in his Santa outfit hunting. It was bizarre, but it's something I would expect to see on a British soap opera. Do you know what I mean? So that's when it started happening to me. Then you had the next, which is, I think, them at home for Christmas, like Christmas Eve before they go over there. And again, it just reeked of either Christmas movie or
Hallmark Christmas special.
Well, that's what I mean. Not Hallmark. What really caught my attention on this film was the Britishness of the acting and the Britishness of the scenes. Like it was quintessentially set so that you would think you were watching this on ITV, BBC, Channel 5. Does that make sense? Like that's where I got the soap opera.
Yeah, like I completely agree. And once I kind of got on board with that, it made the film more enjoyable. Again, from a filmmaking point of view, from a, like, you know, genre mashing kind of point of view, I think very interesting.
Yeah, and so story-wise, like, that's not... And I don't believe people in soap operas are bad actors, so, Danny Dyer, don't get mad at me.
Please. It's a very special kind of acting, right?
It is, it is. And it's being used here not because of bad acting, it's being used to counter this other half of the story. So the other half of the story, since you've all watched it, obviously these people are possessed by the Fallen. So this is like the devil and his brood, which I am a big fan of those types of stories. Don't ask me why. I just love them.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Absolutely love them. I didn't find that super clear. I at no point was I like, oh, okay, I get who they are.
But
I was okay with that. Yeah,
it was very reminiscent of, you know, one of the coolest things I ever got to do. And it's funny because this is a creative telling you this, and this isn't like my $1 billion film I got to make. This isn't, you know, whatever. If I remember some of the cool creative moments in my life, it's when I was 17 and I got to play the devil in a reading of Paradise Lost that we did.
Cool.
And basically all my crazy goth friends and I, we took over Perkins, the local coffee shop. We gave us permission to get a private room, and we went through and we read Paradise Lost as if it were a play. And that way everybody had a part. Why do I say that? Well, when they speak, okay, so when they're the demons and they're speaking, they take on the Milton-esque tone that he has, that kind of, it's very formal, very proper kind of thing. So that is why I just thought it was a great juxtaposition. So you have like the soap opera speak for when it's normal and when your attentions are supposed to be eased, and then they up it again by changing it into this more formal kind of talking. That is intermittent with both the playfulness of the devils. You know what I mean? They are quite playful. Sinister, but playful, especially the lead character, who goes from being like a really nice bit of a Wally, if I'm honest, like just kind of a, your average, you know, I messed up my hair, I'm a bit of an idiot, to this really sinister kind of killer. And he's like, you know, we're coming back and we're doing it via you. I think those are the elements that make it such a watchable film, because, you know, obviously the worst scene, the scene that everybody, the one I was warned about, and I wish I hadn't been, because I could see it coming. So when she is giving her cancer speech, and God, it was forever the fucking, you know, cancer speech.
That actress crushed that speech, by the way. Like, I up until that moment, I really hadn't kind of cared about any of the characters, but she crushed it.
But the sound design works so well, because again, they've put it in the background. They've twinkled in this Hallmark kind of soap opera music right before. I mean, even when the hammer hits her head, you stop for a minute. You say, "What just happened?"
Yeah, yeah.
And then like 10 seconds later, it's like, "Wow, that just happened."
Yeah, yeah.
And like,
I will say that you know, because this was an incredible practical effect that they did, obviously. But I liked a lot of their effects, like the light in the mouth that you see throughout the throughout the film. Like, really cool, really simple. I think it was probably a mixture of practical, as in literally they put a light in someone's mouth, plus, like, CG, like, enhancement and stuff. But, yeah, like, the head. Okay, so I, like, Eric, who, you know, listens to the show and stuff.
Hey, Eric.
He kind of has a pet peeve with, like, skull-crushing scenes and the extreme gore of it.
We're here, and I think I've put it on a podcast. You remind me in the comments if I've said it in a podcast before, but we are brothers. You know that anyway. You do. You know, I haven't had a chance to email Eric back yet. I've had the Eric has done us some great posters for What Are You Guys Talking About, and let me give a personal shout out that I was amazed with how they look, so yeah. I will be emailing Eric to finalize them all up, but thank you so much. But another thing you can cheer about is, yes, okay, so it started with Irreversible, alright, and I'm gonna ruin all these movies, so if you don't want spoilers, turn this off for 5 minutes, but Irreversible, it's one of my favorite horrible movies, okay? Because it's on that list of 10 most vile films of all time. I went through that phase. I wanted to watch the sickest stuff I could find with it still being legal, at least, guys. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I don't go further than that. I have no desire to see real people die. I have a desire to see horror films done to their most extreme.
Yeah.
So, I never
went through that.
Yeah, I don't know. I met other horror people that did, and occasionally on the boards you get people that's like, oh, I just watched August or Underground. What else should I watch? And it's like, if you've watched Kurt Vogel's Best, then you've seen probably the most deprived horror films.
Have you seen Sallow?
Yeah. I've seen them all, mate. Like, I really did have a list, and I wanted to... Again, it was almost like, I think when you're a horror junkie, and maybe this is an interesting point for the podcast for some of you, like, if you're a horror junkie, it becomes like an endurance test. So, the ones that really got me and really sold me on amazement at just how real it could look was the Japanese guinea pig series. I watched... Now, everybody loves Flowers of Flesh and Blood. That is the guinea pig. These were all made in the 80s by Japanese special effects artists. They are amazing. Yeah. And you have to watch the behind the scenes as well, because even in the 80s, they were doing stuff that we still can't do 100% properly over here. But Flowers of Flesh and Blood is famous because Charlie Sheen watches this and thinks it's a real snuff film. So he goes to the FBI. This is back in the era of VHS. And the FBI, like... we're ready to arrest everyone on this thing. And we're like, guys. So they produced the behind the scenes just to be like, no. This is fake.
Special effects. So
the one that got me was called The Devil's Experiment. And these have all been done by Americans, by the way. So if you want to see the American Guinea Pig series, they're not... I've seen them, and I don't think they're as good, but they are a modern kind of retake on this. One of them is an exorcism done with one of my favorite people in L.A., Jessica Cameron. She's awesome, and she plays the possessed woman in that, and it is gory as all fuck. So if you're into that kind of thing, check it out, man. It's been out for a while now. But so the old guinea pig series, The Devil's Experiment, really all it was, you know, girl in seat, and they torture her for like 2 hours. And the ending scene that everybody remembers is they poke out her eye with a needle, and it's as vivid as it gets. It's very much like Unchien, the one by Salvador Dali where they cut the woman's eye, and it's all over.
Okay.
Unchien Andalou is that famous film. Mm-hmm. So my point is, there's allurement with that. And it's not... I don't know where that comes from. Like, I don't want to say it's me. I want to watch someone get tortured. But it's the kind of the amazement that it can go on screen and go on for so long. Like, it's the same reason Martyrs is so powerful to me. Have you watched Martyrs?
No, that's another one that I've been kind of like, I know I should, but I kind of really don't want to.
for the sake of not ranting too much about this, that element of it, I'm going to park the discussion on Uber Horror there and say we will pick it up in a Martyrs podcast.
you put me through. Oh my god.
Yeah, no, I have to, because I want you to see what I'm talking about when again, this is you getting to know your fans, Eddie, because you know, we're going to make a horror movie and you need to know what the crazy ones are watching, because there's a good chunk of us. It's part of, like, you know, just like people into rock music have like different parts of rock history, like this is part of like horror history. If you want like the first ones, go to like Lucio Fulci. Zombie 2 is the one with the splinter through the eye that kind of did it. But I always remember his famous one, which is called The Beyond, where I think I've told you this one a million times. The opening scene, I remember seeing this at 14 and I just couldn't believe it. Like, the guy gets first, like, he's a bad man, right? So they're doing something to the bad man. And the acting's terrible because this is Italian horror. So, you know, it doesn't make any sense. But there's a bad man and everybody in the village needs to get him. So first thing they do is they crucify him to a stone wall. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty epically... I mean, this isn't that's like a extreme. Mild crucifixion. Yeah, yeah. This is like bam, and there's like 20 people doing this, and you're like, what's wrong with you people? He's not that kind of guy. Like, he didn't do nothing. You know what I mean? And so, and then they start whipping him, but they don't whip him with whips. They whip him with chains, and so the chains start ripping his flesh off. There's these scenes where the flesh is ripping away, and you're like, wow, like these people are crazy. Okay, that stops for all of like 2 seconds, and then you see this guy pick up this big white bucket of white stuff, and I'm like, what the fuck is that? And he throws lye all over his body, so he melts.
Oh my gosh.
Cue the credits. And it, you know, at 14, I was like, oh my god, this is the coolest film I've ever seen.
See, I just, I guess I never kind of went through that. I never experienced that. I remember, like, Japanese anime having a big influence on, like, my kind of levels of violence and the things that I enjoyed in films, and then, you know, later Kurosawa and stuff like that. But it's very interesting. I will say that on this film, I think it's quite extreme, but it's fairly short. Again, going to Eric, who doesn't like that kind of scene, I would say still watch it, because that's just like a very small part of it. There's plenty more here for you to enjoy.
Oh, Jesus. And yeah, sorry, Eric. Going back to your original point, Eric, on the head caving thing. So, starts with the Irreversible, when they go in the gay club in that one. That was the first time I saw that scene that you're talking about, where the guy smashes the head once, then you see, like, head dented, and then for some reason, the camera fixates on the head, and we smash the head until it looks like an effing, you know, broken cantaloupe. That has been done so many times now. Hereditary has a scene that has that in there. Midsommar had a scene that had that in there.
Yeah.
I could probably name any movie I've probably watched that has horror in it in the past year that has an epic gory scene. For some reason, we love action movies do it too, though. They just don't show the head. So the new thing to do in, like, action, all the Marvel stuff I'm watching is like, oh, if we want to see, say he's crazy, we smash the head off screen, but we do it so much we're sure that person's head is like pulp now.
Caved in. I've got to say, I really liked the stabbing scene, which was the other, like, very gory moment that I remember.
To be fair, there's really only three, right? There's the head bashing, which is quick, like you said, and then afterwards, it's not really comical, but it is, because it's like, it's literally just looks like a cow pat of someone's, of you know, whatever, and it's like, wow, like, that person went to town, and, and you know what I mean? It's so, it's not that it looks fake, it just looks like, well, I'm not really sure I'm disgusted by that anymore. I'm kind of just like, shit, where do we go to after this? Like, how do we pick up from this? No pun intended.
That's a very good point. And I feel that it did pivot a couple of times. Like, I remember feeling a kind of Funny Games vibe, you know, like of you know, people being sequestered in their house and being forced to do horrible things to each other. I also got some, like, Us vibes, particularly in that scene where Lucy speaks to the boy, Ben. And she kind of gives you some background, but I don't know if that ever really paid off. I just really liked the scene. I thought she crushed that as well.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think they're trying to do a couple things here, but where this movie works for me is in its simplicity. All right? The head gag. So why do you have to have the head gag? You don't have to have the head gag. Eric, let me try to explain to you again, because I think it's a really good point, you know, you're bringing up to Ed, and we are all tired of the head smashing trope. But why does it come up so often? So that's really the question, is why are we seeing it in so many films? If you're asking a producer, at least. The reason you're seeing it is because it fills the seats. And, like, unfortunately, it's a trope, and it's a trope that is way overused now. However, it's something you have to have. So you know, we're doing You Reap What You Sow, which is part of a compilation for a feature and everything. And one of the things in the brief we received from the producer on this, from Lori, is has to have some gore. You know, it has to have something. And people don't always respect that. But, like, horror movies without the gore and horror movies without the splatter, at least to a normal horror crowd, someone that goes to Fright Fest every year and wants to see that, can be really off-putting. So if you're making your first feature into a horror film, and you know it's going to go the Fright Fest route, Grim Fest, might try to go over to the States and do some of the ones over there, maybe Nightmares in Columbus. Like, you're going to put a big gore scene in there. Why? Right. Because it's your first film and you need to establish.
It's
a selling point.
It's again.
Exactly.
It's also the thing that you know, people say, like, horror makes its money back and stuff. It's because
that's what I'm saying. When I'm going to Borders, or when I'm going to Cannes and I'm trying to market this to a distributor and saying, I need you to pick this up and I need you to either put it straight on iTunes is fine. Mm. That's usually what's going to happen. Like, we're going to do the film festival circuit, but then I need you to put this on iTunes for blah, blah, blah. Mm. They're going to say, well, why would I do that? What's going to make people watch this? When I tell them there's a scene in here where a woman's head gets literally flattened to a pancake with a hammer, they're going to say, well, that's pretty epic. And like,
It's a selling point. It's definitely a selling point. I've got to say, though, that one of the things that I appreciated about that scene, though, is that it was preceded by a really emotional, like, delivery of an uplifting kind of moment for these characters, and then from that moment it just all goes downhill.
And that's why I want to give Adam and Richard a bit more credit, because we've been talking about tropes and we've been talking about, like, it's so common. I think here they probably knew how common this is now, and we're trying. They did a really good job, because now we're past half hour mark, so I'll get more into story. They did a really good job pushing and pulling that way. So you've got the big pull, and you're completely off in this kind of, you know, from my perspective, I was getting a bit bored. I was like, oh man, like, how much cutesy shit are we going to have here? Like, thought this was supposed to be a home invasion, and doesn't anyone not notice the crazy girl, like, that hasn't said a word across the table?
I know,
like,
that haven't eaten any of the food and all that kind of stuff.
And that's why I would say, I think we're dealing with two, you know, and Richard and Adam, if you want to put it in the comments, go ahead, but two more intelligent filmmakers there. Mm. Because you have the E.T. shot, and you know me, Ed, I love the E.T. shots. The E.T. shot, guys, and actually the proper E.T. shot is Ray. So Steven Spielberg, when he does these table shots, he raises the camera above, and he'll shoot it down.
Yeah.
And that's your 80s family, and we're gonna, because we got to talk about WandaVision in a minute. I'm not finished with the next episode, but I've watched half of it.
We
talk a little bit at the end here.
Interesting.
But so you've got the overhead shot there. What he's done is he's done, again, I love wide shots. He's done a wide shot from the end of the table, and that was actually, I would say, my preferred, because then I think you're more at eye level with everybody and can kind of get the conversation. But this makes it weird, because you, in your foreground, you have one of the two villains, and that just sits there. While all these things are going on, so there's the discussion about the boyfriend and the marriage, and then there's babies, and then there's all this, and it's all going on around them, and I love the fact that you're not really paying attention to them anymore. You know something bad is going to happen. Like, there's no doubt when they come in the house that you are sure, mischief is going to be managed.
Again,
however,
they
lull you to sleep with the cutesy shit, and so that's why when it hits so powerfully, and why it's worth your money. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I will also say there's great, again, throughout the whole film, great camera movement. You know, where the camera slides down, and you can see that she's holding the hammer, and it comes back up. And actually, one of the things that I recognized quite early on as a limitation of their budget, which I'm not sure what it was, but I'm fairly sure it was micro budget, right?
It did say micro budget. Yeah, it was definitely micro budget. So micro budget means that's under 100,000, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, one of the limitations is definitely, like, sets, and this was obviously filmed in someone's house, you know, where they had the space that they had, right?
Yeah, no, it was the director's house.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
yeah. So you know, I found that. You know, just a thing that I recognize in, like, my films and you know, our films, and just that, like, you know, we use what we've got kind of thing, you know, which I like. It made me appreciate the film even more, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think the comment that was made when I was doing the research on this, because they were doing an interview, and they said, listen, we looked at a couple of different places, but then we realized we could just kind of gear up the director's house, so we just decided, or it might have been one of the producers, but it was somebody's house on crew. They're like, we'll just do that, you know. That's often with first time films, indie filmmaking, again, micro budget, so under 100,000, you really don't have anything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whatever you can get away with, that's why the film looks amazing for that, you know what I mean. And I just, the reason we're bringing on the show is because we definitely want to make films like that.
They definitely put the money in a lot of the right places, I think.
And
again, the lighting for me, you know, they must have rented some pretty powerful lights for those night scenes. There's one in particular, when Lucy is like hanging, right? And I thought that was really interesting, and I've taken like a little screenshot of it, and I want to send it to you because, again, it's nighttime, but there's very clearly a light source, but it's, you know, in the background. It's so it very clever filmmaking throughout.
That's right. So, I mean, what comments more could I say about Store that I haven't said about Push and Pull and things like that? Well, I think overall what you're seeing is how they commercialized the story. You know, they took something that, you know, they put the cutesy elements in because, you know, people might, you know, even I was getting bored by them, but we've all watched, or at least all of us will have someone in our house that's watched Gavin and Stacey or has watched, you know, Only Fools and Horses, that loves that kind of BBC Christmas vibe that comes with British television. And they nailed that. They absolutely nailed that. So the other thing I will say about Story, though, is the way that it informed, it seems to have, as Ed is saying, seems to have informed the production budget. And that is a crucial thing that often I don't talk about on this show, but that God knows that delves very deeply into the kind of writing I do and when I'm setting things up to get made. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Well, they had a good script and they knew it, but they also understood what their script was trying to do. And I do find first-time filmmakers, when I watch debut, especially Fright Fest first-timers, some get it really right and some just don't. So, you know, other good examples, Adam Stovall, we've talked about him at length with The Ghost Waits. Yeah. The Stylist is another one that we're going to get Ed on to. You know, you're going to watch Coherence either tonight or tomorrow.
Yeah,
that's going to be another one. And we'll talk about that at the end of the podcast, kind of why we're doing that. But these are ones where you get the script and it's not just writing a good script. It's understanding how the audience is going to perceive that script. So here, they understood enough to get actors that they knew could deliver the type of acting they needed. Mm-hmm. You'll notice, and I was surprised about this because I checked to see whether there are any names. Mm-hmm. Because there's usually at least one. You know what I mean? With Fright Fest and stuff like that, we're generally, we will pull, you know, someone from the horror community to champion your film and say, you know, Nick Burnham Vince, you're the nicest guy, you do it for a lot of people's films. You know what I mean? But point being that, like, there's usually a couple names in there, and there weren't on this one. However, when you go to the IMDb, you find out that all these people do have acting experience. They're just not people that regularly act on, you know, a high-level stage, you know, with features and something like that. So I thought that was a really prudent choice. But again, like you said, they cut back on other elements. Where do you see, and maybe this is just to help out a little bit, where do you see where they skimped on things? Maybe the house would be one.
Yeah, definitely locations. You know, they did what they had to do. I think, like you say, you know, not necessarily bringing in a big name that might, you know, require paying a significant amount.
That's right.
Because
go ahead. Because the script's focus is on those gore scenes, and that's what I'm saying. Like, they knew that. They knew it's not about who's playing the lead actor or the villain at the time. Mm. It's actually about who's going to be smashing that head and what that's going to look like and what do we need to put into that.
Yeah.
And the teeth pulling and the and the stabbing.
Yeah, definitely. I think those elements are huge. But I'll be honest. For me, the work of Richard Oakes as, you know, the DOP, he also co-directed it, I think, and co-wrote it, is really quite incredible. And if you look at you know, his credits and stuff, he's worked as a DOP on a lot of shorts. And music videos and stuff like that, and you can just tell that he has really kind of sharpened his craft. The guy can light a scene. There's a brilliant scene with Michael, who's the old man, and he's talking about the TV, and the way he's backlit with a kind of cool light to represent kind of nighttime, right? And then, rather than a key and a fill, he just uses a fill, which is a little bit warm, so it casts a beautiful shadow.
Yeah.
And just he really, you know, often they talk about cinematographers kind of painting with light, and he really, really did that, I felt.
No, I would completely agree. It's funny you bring up that actor too, Michael. Like, I was interested because I thought that was the name. Like, the first time I watched it, I was like, I went back because I was for sure. I was like, I know I've seen him before and something else. And I hadn't. And that was the interesting thing. It was like, that's what I mean when you pick actors that can deliver. Like, because I felt like, oh, I think I've seen him on Benidorm or something like that. Like, somewhere.
Yeah.
I've seen him. And it wasn't. They just picked an actor that could deliver the chops to that degree and make sure that it was coming through. So, but yeah, cinematography definitely adds to that. It's another reason to, if you find a good DOP and you like what they work, make sure you, you know, you don't have to pay them a ton, but, you know, get experience there, because that really will be one of...
Get them excited for your story, I think. Do you know what
I mean? That's what we do. Yeah, we have access to some decent DOPs, more than decent, some excellent DOPs. Sorry, Sash. Sorry, Ricky. But that's, we get them on board by making them excited about things, by saying, like, this is dope, giving them the script and then talking them through it. And most of the time, they're on our side for it. But it's because you're going to be dealing with talented people who are going to be busier and busier the more talented they get. So you need to sell them on, you know, the concept being good. Here, you know, you just had two talented people making a film. That's another thing to notice about this, guys, is this is the approach where they do it all themselves. That is an approach. You know what I mean? You just have to notice that the approach taken by these two is because both of them, if you look at their IMDbs, had experience with music video, short films, a few other things. You know what I mean? This wasn't their first trip around the park. So that's what I would say. Otherwise, and this is something that I've learned, and I'm telling you more from my perspective. So if you're more like me, where you don't have that tons of experience, you do have to enlist some really experienced people in and just get them enthusiastically involved. God forbid, you may actually have to pay them too. So that's the kind of thing. But I guess it's the reason we're hampering on about all of this is because that's what makes a successful film. The attention to detail on the sound design on this one was the other one. You know, most people don't go back and throw in those mood tracks. And I would say do it every time. Why? Because A, it can't cost that much money. We're talking about flavor music. So flavor music you can usually buy off the shelf for like $20 or $70 at most to get the licensing for it. You know what I mean? And at least then you've got... You had those moments where you were being cued. You were cued, you know, up, and then you were cued back down. And I just think that
there were just some very interesting choices, like the Sugar Plum Fairy, like off key, you know.
Oh, which I forgot about that. That was awesome.
Brilliant.
Yeah
really, really cool.
Really, really like that. Yeah.
And you know, I think that inevitably there is. You can be overbearing with sound design and music to try and push emotion, and I think that these guys never pushed it too far in this film. It was always, you know, well structured. It helped the story move forward and the tension to build. So, yeah, brilliant work.
That's right. And again, I think that comes from the subtlety. So actors like EastEnders, but not EastEnders. Story written to a certain extent. Gore scenes, very gory, but not a whole bucket of blood throughout the whole thing. Right. Again, with the music, you've got good sound design, but this isn't a Tarantino film. And I think that's part of it. First film, they set themselves some really achievable boundaries.
Yeah.
And Ed, you know I'm saying this to myself right now, because this seems to be one of my biggest problems is achievable boundaries, right?
Yeah.
But that's what I would very much...
It's a very great lesson in literally that. Achievable goals. Get done.
It's tough because for me, it's always a tension and pride. So the idea is you worry, but I've been told I have to make the best script possible. I've been told I have to use the best actors possible. I've been told I have to use the best, and best. Well, you put all the best into everything, and man, the bill that's going to come out of that is going to be bill and time.
Or it never happens because you've got to spend so much time and energy to get to the things that you want to do. And it's not... I'm not advocating for compromise, you know, across the board. I know that there's people, writers, who you know, they want to get more out of themselves, actors as well, cinematographers, everyone who feels creative in filmmaking. And so I think that it's just a really good lesson in, you know... Know your limits and try and get the best, but get it done, right?
Yeah, I guess like the problem is we usually just say get the best, and that's not entirely true. It's more get what the best of what you can get and then use it to its best of its ability. Yeah. So often in the indie world, that's what I find the real trick. Yeah. It's not finding the best. Sometimes you do get lucky and you get that actor that's free and can do something, or you know, that director that's like, well, you know, I'll help you out because I owe you one. Usually it doesn't happen that way though, especially because you're gonna say, I ain't got any money to pay you though. what you do get is you'll get an enthusiastic person in that's probably got some skills at it. And it's all about you developing that and saying, what skills do they have? What can we develop?
Yeah.
What, you know, what at hand, and can you make it best? So that is where, as an indie, you may do the 20 takes of something, because that's where you can shine. Now, if you're doing 20 takes and blowing off your production schedule, then well, you're going to hear it in a minute. Right. But you should definitely build into your pre-production and build into your production schedule more time for these things, because that's where you're going to be able to get better value. And so that's the indie difference between, you know, if we all worked at Warner Brothers, we all worked at Fox, or, you know, Fox, which is part of Disney now, or anything like that, then you have access to good money and the best of the best. And so that is when you're able to say, I want my departments filled with the very best and brightest in this. I would still try to find that for your indie film, but then make sure with whatever you have to hand, whether you actually have departments or not, you are, you know, constantly honing that. That's where we see the amazingness, the camera skill, the attention to detail.
And so much of it does end up becoming a team building exercise, you know, where you need to work on things, meet art directors, you need to, you know, meet sound designers and get to work on them, begin to trust them. And, you know, I think that filmmaking, unlike so many other art forms, is very much a team effort. And so understanding that is a really important thing.
Yeah, definitely. I think the hardest perspective comes from the writer. I think writers are the feistiest. And again, it's because I'm a multiple personality person, so I have all three of these people inside. But a writer is definitely the feistiest. Those are the ones that, you know, if they're not wedded to getting rid of their scripts, because that's, you know, professional writers, I guess they're more wedded to that. But the ones we encounter definitely have feistiness about their scripts. Then you get to directors, and I you know, the experience I have with directors is, in my own self with this problem, is that you can get carried away with the art, and you can just want and want and want and want without being realistic about what's achievable in the time that you have.
Yep.
And then you get to the producer, which is the other side of the coin. The producer is the not feisty one. The producer, like, as a producer, and I do still think that's the biggest hat that I wear, the whole thing's about getting the film made, okay? And if you're a good producer, and I don't, you know, I'm not saying I'm a good producer, but I'm saying, you know, if you're a good producer, you want the focus to be on getting it made and getting it commercially out there. You know what I mean? Yeah. Nothing great about getting a film made that goes nowhere, because what, you know, I guess my view on that is, what does that say to the cast and crew that worked on it? You know what I mean? Like,
it's very true.
Unfortunately, if I can't put it in the market somewhere, then no one's going to see all the hard work everybody's put into it.
Exactly. And I think that this film really does a great job of balancing that, of understanding, you know, that it needs to be commercially accessible in some ways, you know, and I'm so happy for them that they ended up third in the iTunes.
Yeah, well, that's why we put it on the show, because a lot of times, you know, in outside conversations, outside the podcast, a lot of it, not too many times, but people will ask, like, how do you know this stuff? You know, like, what's a good indie film versus another indie film? How are we supposed to know the difference? And is this just your opinion? Like, yes, generally it is just our opinion. However, like, we also look at the statistics, you know, and this shows a film that rose to prominence in January. This guy will definitely have people knocking on his door for the next bit, because he's made money the first time. And that's the name of the game. Like it's all about you working on something so you can get the next thing in the bag. Now, I know everybody has their passion projects, but, you know, you also want to be a filmmaker. You may never get to your passion projects. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's true. Like, sometimes you take a shot and you know, it doesn't work out. But I think for these guys, I'm happy that it has worked out. And, you know, the only real kind of hard, you know, numbers that you can look at is, you know, how much it makes and sales and stuff like that. So, you know, if it's doing well on iTunes, I'm really happy for them, and I'm excited to see what they come up with next.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the other end of that, I know it because I read, God, a book every month, you know, that has some of this in there. But just so you know, audience, because not all of you are like indie filmmakers or people that have been around it forever, like, your first feature film that you're going to come out with, you are generally never going to see that money again. You know what I mean? Like, you're not going to make anything from that film. It is there so that you can get someone to talk to about a bigger film for your second film. Like, as much as we've talked the shorts or the calling cards, like, this is your next calling card. Right. When you market this, You're going to try to recover and break even. If you break even on your feature film, your first one, you're like, wow, we finally did it.
We did it.
We did it, you know, because so often that just doesn't happen, you know. Yeah. So that's something to bear in mind. Like, you shouldn't go into this thing, I'm going to make one feature film and I'm going to be rich. Like, trust me, we talk to guys that have now done their first feature. That's not what they're doing. They are now very avidly advocating for their second film to get made, which will hopefully be millions as opposed to micro. You know what I mean? So that's the ladder. Now, you can jump. We always joke about it with our filmmaking friends that one day we'd like to do the Disney jump and just be picked out of a hat and said, by the way, you're going to be a big director now. But that rarely, in all honesty, happens. And the formula is there for a reason. You know what I mean? It's there to help you get to where you want to be. So exactly. Just keep that in mind.
Yeah. It's, you know, I think sometimes people think of, you know, filmmaking as like, you know, you get a hit and boom, that's it. You're in Hollywood and this and that. But I think there is like a path, a formula, like you say, that can lead you to, you know, becoming good at your craft, proving that you can deliver, and then being given the chance to do that with significant money.
It's why I understand the comments about, like, go become a lawyer, not a filmmaker, because I think too many people approach this angle, especially people that aren't, like, that I don't know in the film circles, people that ask me about kind of my transition, you know, it's funny I say my transition into being a filmmaker, and kind of what that's been like, going from, like, a corporate job, which I still work, by the way, you know, and do that. But the corporate job, guys, is what, I mean, I'm not rich by any means, but what allows me to have a little funny money and to have some fun with it, like... Most of the artists I know, if not all the artists I know, struggle because cash is not easy to come by when you're on a gig economy. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just how it is. But that's what I mean. Like, how many do we have as friends now? And how many do we know? That's why, you know, if you are an artist and you ever want lunch, come find me. Because I'm always like, I've always got my Amex. And I'm like, oh, whatever. Like, I don't care. It's lunch. Like,
and I am bad. Jason is very generous.
on a lunch. You know what I mean? Like, I just believe that's part of what I do as a producer is taking people out to lunch. So, yes, if you're come up with a pitch and find me. And, you know, you can get a lunch off me pretty easily. I have a burger or something like that. But that's what I mean. It's because, like... And I totally respect that. Like, it's just the difference. If you are looking at this angle and you're like, I want to be a filmmaker, but I can't do it unless I make a lot of money, well, then you can't do it. Like, right. If it's the money that makes it so you need to be a filmmaker, then you're not looking at this properly.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, you will not become rich by being a filmmaker. That's just not generally how it goes.
Not really. Like, you can earn a good salary in the film world, but, you know, in terms of, like, creativity and what you can kind of... put out into the world, it's not going to be the same, you know, and those are the sacrifices that you make to, I don't know, to tell stories and to a certain extent leave a legacy, you know. I don't know if I'm ever going to have kids. My films are going to be kind of what lives past me, you know. So
that's right. And I just think it's important to realize that, because and really examine that for yourself, guys. If you are one of those people, and we're all there, especially God knows in February of COVID, you know, but if you're one of those people that's sitting there and wondering, you know, and you're saying, like, am I really doing this right? Or, you know, is it really too long a road? Really ask yourself if you can deal without the cash, because I just know too many people that should be getting, you know, jobs otherwise and not worrying about the film so much because they don't have that kind of passion for it. Because once it starts getting hard, that's when they're going to say, well, I'd rather be doing something else. So, and there's nothing wrong. I guess my whole point is there's nothing wrong with saying that. Like,
yeah,
it's better for you to admit that maybe you just like watching films rather than making them, you know, rather than spend too much time on this. And again, it's coming from, because we've had a lot of meetings, and none of this is directed at anyone I've had a meeting with, by the way. You've all been lovely to meet and talk to, and your enthusiasm pours through. But I guess that's my point, is I do meet on the street and otherwise, you know, other people when I talk about film that have that new idea but just don't have that passion. They're like, you know, we're going to get famous from this. And it's like, well, it's not really about getting famous. It's about getting your message across.
Yeah.
And you have to be really dedicated to the message part, because otherwise you're probably not going to make it.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a tough thing as well, because you deal with actors who you know, they trade on fame. If they become more famous, they get more roles, they get offered more money, you know. So there's definitely an element of that, but like you say, you know, you've got to go in with the idea that, you know, you're in it for the long haul, that it's what you kind of inside of you you really want to do. And even then, there's going to be days of doubt and moments
actors are a really good example of that. I just assumed that actors always did it for the money, that it was like everybody who signed up to become an actor, mm-hmm. at least that moved out to Hollywood to be an actor, was doing it as like a crapshoot. And it was like, because to be fair, and I do have certain qualms with this, when we were growing up, like the movies we watched, that's how it's always described. It's like, and certainly that's how my parents described it. It's like, well, if you want to ruin your life, you can pick up sticks, move to LA and try to make it as an actor. That's what people do when they can't, you know, when they can't hack it at anything else and they want to try to win the lottery and become famous.
Mm-hmm.
Then I met real actors. And I mean, you know, I think the more important ones are when I met famous actors. And like, that has so little to do with it for most of them. Famous or not. Like, that's the funniest thing. It doesn't matter if they're famous or not. They do it because they love the art. You know what I mean? Because they
And it's a true art, man. Like, acting, I have so much respect for actors.
So that's all I mean is you know, if you sit here and you say, God, I'll never have enough money to be a filmmaker, we're like... You don't need any money to be a filmmaker. That's the whole point.
Right. Don't worry.
And you're not going to have money as a filmmaker. That's just how it is. So that is why we tip our hat today to you know, indie gem that this was, hosts. I'd say definitely go out and watch it. If you are that indie filmmaker, take Ed's notes on the story stuff's cool, but I think Ed's notes on the camera work are probably where this one really locked it in. That's where they get their distribution deal. That's where they get number 3 on iTunes. The story is good, but you need to make it look perfect for that iTunes number 3 to show up. So take that home with you and you know, listen to my ramblings about stories as well.
Absolutely.
But okay, it looks like we've actually gotten to the end of the hour. I've only halfway watched WandaVision, Ed, so maybe we won't talk about it.
Are you feeling low or what?
It comes back to what I was talking about with the American sitcom thing. Like, they are riding that heavy because, mate, this is literally pulling every sitcom Americans will have watched.
Yeah. I learned something quite interesting, which I didn't know. But a trailer for The Falcon and the Winter Soldier dropped, you know, during...
recently,
Super Bowl. Super Bowl. Congrats, Tampa.
Don't say that on air, please. Sorry. Tom, you are the most awesome dude ever, right? When it comes to football, I just wanted to see a year where you weren't winning. But
I
then
was
again,
happy for her, man.
And I was about to say, in 10 years' time, when we're friends and I've met you, I'll be like, yeah, no, that was just sour.
Him and Gronk, man. Like, I was happy for them.
You know what I mean? Greatest of all time. You know, it's amazing. I never thought that would happen, but the game was amazing to watch as well. So.
So, you know, the Falcon and the Winter Soldier dropped, and it feels very much like a traditional kind of Marvel MCU action adventure. Yeah. And I didn't know this, but originally it was supposed to come out before WandaVision.
That's right. That's
right. And it's so interesting because I feel like maybe they were worried that WandaVision was just... a bit too big of a departure from the MCU, so they put it in second. But then they were like, you know, when everything happened, they were like, you know what, we're gonna like double down and say WandaVision is interesting and it's a new look. And I don't know, man, like, my brother's not really enjoying it very much. I get where he's coming from. He kind of talked about some of the stuff that we talked about in the first 3 episodes. But yeah, the 4th and the 5th episode, man, are brilliant.
Yeah, like I said, halfway through with 4, I mean, or with 5, and obviously I'm at the point where, like, the two babies have gotten older now, they're talking, and, like, Vision's starting to notice some things that are weird, and they're talking about that, so it literally was because, like, I did it, and then had to end my lunch break and get back to things, so I will finish it up tonight, and hopefully we can talk more about it, but... No, I'm generally loving it. Like, I definitely, it's like all
we're
the new stuff.
We're past halfway as well. It's 9 episodes, right? So that's kind of interesting.
That's right. So
like, coming next?
It was funny because it's funny you bring that up because I haven't watched it because I've been trying to get through Luke Cage, and actually this came on my lunch break where Luke Cage broke me a bit.
Really?
It does from time to time. Well, I really like the story because obviously. I'm actually reading about the Harlem Renaissance, as most of you have heard podcast. And obviously this takes place in Harlem and is all about that. So it's a really good link. And the story is good. You know, his father shows up in the second season. But once again, we got to episode 9, and it was the end. That was an ending. Like, something major happens, and it actually resolves. Like, in the writing, they're doing the whole, like, shaking hands, and it was great to see you. And you could clearly tell that someone was sticking the middle finger up to Jeff Loeb and being like, this is where we ended the script.
Well, no, apparently it was Netflix who demanded 13 episodes.
Oh, God, it's like horrible.
They wanted to do, like, 9, 10, and Netflix were like, no, it's got to be 13.
It's so clear that that's happened here because episode 10, the bad guy, you know, just to, and I'm not ruining because I'm not telling you what's happening, but in 10, the bad guy that you thought was dead gets away.
Yeah.
And then, to my great ire, Iron Fist shows up and is like, I need to help you find this guy. And I was like, this is the most tagged in, stretched fucking episode with the worst of the characters.
I really don't want to watch
this guy do anything. I'm going to really cringe the entire series of Iron Fist.
Mate.
And this is what I mean. So I was like, I'm watching WandaVision. Screw it. I'm only going to catch half of it on my lunch
palette
break.
Palette cleanser.
No, I was like, I'm only going to catch like 20 minutes of it on my lunch break because I got to get back to work, but I'm going to watch it, damn it.
So that's how that went.
So, sure. We'll talk more about it next time. But yeah, MCU nearly done. Luke Cage, and then one more episode of Cloak and Dagger, and I'm on Ant-Man and Wasp. Then I have four more shows to watch, and then I'm on Captain Marvel, and then Cloak and Dagger, and I'm finally at you know, Avengers Endgame, which we will, of course, do a podcast.
Yes.
On, why wouldn't
we? Of course.
But I had thought, I had tried to hope to finish that by New Year's, and I'm like, well, March is looking good right now. March is looking very good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, you know, so epic time. And we're doing Coherence next, right?
Right. So, interestingly enough, tonight Ed and I have to... I'll finish watching WandaVision and then probably switch straight to Coherence. Because tonight we have to watch Coherence because tomorrow we're actually recording. Now, we won't see it until next week, guys. So, be ready for next week's podcast. But we are podcasting with a special guest. So, Mitch Bain, one of my Fright Fest buddies, musical composer, writer extraordinaire. He's just an awesome guy. And, I was so chuffed, and it was really cool because today he was like, dude, can you give me the website? Because I kind of want to know everything about you guys before I go on the show. And he knows a lot about us already. Like, he's been a friend of mine for a really long time. But he runs his own podcast as well. Again, I've mentioned it, Strong Language and Violent Scenes. You really, if you're not listening to that podcast,
Andy Gray,
and you listen to us, like, you should be listening to that. Their show is, if you want us with more coherence, that's like, there's two people. It's Andy Stewart and him. They're really funny.
But he's a musician as well, which I always find musicians fascinating people. I'm super excited to just kind of talk to him.
Yeah, so, but at the last minute, not the really last minute, a couple of days before, like, he came and he said, listen, like, I kind of want to do the movie thing too, so can we watch Coherence? And when he suggested it, he was like, it was a 2014 Fright Fest film, and I was like, it sounds familiar, but meh. So then it pulled up on Prime, and I was like, oh, cool, well, at least it's on Prime. And then I pulled up the trailer, and I was like, oh, and this was a film. So I remember the year of this. So some Fright Fest, I buy the pass, right? And when I buy the pass, obviously,
you can get anything you want. Oh, the good old days.
But other years, I buy individual tickets because I'm not going to be able to go for the full 5 days. And I literally will just pick and choose because it's, you know, generally...
That's what I did for the last live one, yeah.
That's right. So this was a year I did that. And I picked... The cool thing with this is you can pick anything you want. So I picked a lot of Discovery Screen, which are like the new things that people can watch. And this was, that year, the best sci-fi thing I watched.
That's awesome.
It was completely crazy. Now, I will warn you, Ed, and the viewer, because you guys could watch this ahead of time, too, if you wanted
to. Yeah, totally. Check it out.
I have fallen asleep to this film at least 3 dozen times when I tried to watch it again, because the intro is really quite slow. It reminds me a little bit of... There's another one like this on Netflix right now that I had to watch 10 times before I got through it. The Invitation.
Okay.
So it has a similar intro to The Invitation where there's a long setup for what's going on.
Okay.
And you won't notice it at first, but just stick with it.
Stick with it.
That's all I'm going to say. Okay. It's only an hour and a half. It's not a long film.
You know me, man. Sci-fi for me is like my complete guilty pleasure. I will always like...
But that's what I mean. The opening part of it, you're going to be like, what?
Okay.
Like, thanks, Jason. This seems really kind of weird. The other cool part about it, and the other reason I remembered it right off the bat, is because it has Xander in it. So if you like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and you like that actor, I can't remember his name offhand, that is the reason I went to see it at Fright Fest.
Okay.
The brochure, they said, oh, Xander's in this film. And I said, I like Xander from Buffy.
Yeah, yeah.
So he plays one of the lead characters in an older role. And I think other elements of this you're really going to dig because it does have some meta moments as well. So, yeah, just watch it.
Awesome.
And we'll be talking about it tomorrow, but you guys will hear about it next week.
Next week, yes. I reckon we might even go into, like, part one and part two with Mitch, because he just seems like such a nice, friendly dude that we're just going to keep talking and talking and talking.
Yeah, you're just saying he doesn't know us very well. You know what I mean?
Like, there's that as well.
Been 3 hours on the podcast and we've talked about a lot. We hope you're not asleep over there. You know what I mean? So I definitely think we'll get that in. So cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us this time. Yes. Like I said, if you haven't watched Hosts and you've listened to all the spoilers, now go out and watch it. It's a good film.
But don't get it confused with The Host, which is a very recent film as well, which is like a Zoom. It was done over quarantine.
Another indie film. And we could have done that one. The reason we haven't done The Host yet is because there was a whole panel. Like, that was the Fright Fest on which Dandelions played. Let me tell you, like, that was the movie that was it, because it was the first COVID film that had really been done. And the guy was a genius for putting it all on.
Mm.
But I haven't watched it myself and haven't really gone back to it since then. I said Host because everybody was picking The Host. It was like, no, there's another one.
Right.
It's just as good, too.
Yeah. Well, thank you for picking it, and thank you guys for listening. Please drop us a comment on it. Let us know what you thought about the film, because, I think anyone who watches it will not be left, like, you know, unmoved.
That's right. No, I think it's worth a watch for everybody, at least one. You may not want to watch it twice, but you definitely want to watch once. Okay, well, thank you very much. Just like tequila with the lick, swallow, suck, please remember to like, subscribe, and comment to our podcast. And we will catch you, as I said, in the next time with the great and glorious Mitch Bain. Bye-bye.
Bye.